his words in loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sound, sound, sound. The word I mentioned earlier today was sangwega, which means like spiritual urgency. And you know, when the Buddha was teaching the monks to practice, one of his analogies was like as if your hair was on fire or your clothes were on fire. I mean, what would you do? Would you just sit there and have a cup of tea? Or would you try and put it out with all your effort? And so all the words you could use to describe the kind of energy and effort you would do to put out that fire, they're the kind of words. So, you know, when you translate them, they use all these words that we don't use in our usual vocabulary. But you can just imagine the kind of effort. You're not gonna think, oh, should I do it or shouldn't I do it? You're going to put it out because otherwise you're going to suffer more. And so that's really like and what we were just chanting, it just popped into my head that in a way a lot of the teachers teach in Thailand is we should really focus on doing our own work first, because if we get too caught up with helping other people before we finish the path, then it's like swimming in the ocean, you know. You might be able to help some other people a little bit, but if you're not a strong swimmer, then you're going to drown and they're going to drown. So in other words, we've got to look after our own house first, you know. We don't need to be, it's not that we don't help people, but we have to have our priorities right, that, you know, by helping ourselves, we are helping other people, you know. So by focusing on our own practice, you know, being diligent, that's how we put out the fires of suffering. And, you know, whatever level we're at, like I was giving a little Dhamma talk yesterday, and talking about, you know, looking at our own defilements. So we're each individual. So, you know, what the way one person practices might be different for another way. So that's why, you know, meditation is not necessarily easy. So you won't find the great forest masters. They're not going to tell you exactly how to meditate, but, you know, they might give a suggestion. But at the end of the day, it's only through our own diligent effort that we will come to realize what the right means is for us, you know. So that's why, even though the masters tell us to keep our practice simple and to practice a lot, they don't say, you know, just do this or just do that only, because, you know, we're all a little bit different. And, you know, in the commentaries, there's 40 classical meditation objects, you know, and like particularly for a monk, you can imagine if you're sitting at the foot of a tree, if you're just looking at your breath and you're not contemplating or doing anything, then, you know, an hour or two goes by and what next? So you can see that the reason for having ability, like having a little bit of a room to move with different things, is because the more that you practice, sometimes your mind might not settle down with the breath. You know, so when I first started meditation, I developed the elements quite a lot. And that, so earth, water, fire, wind, you know. So if you got a thought about somebody, break them down into the elements. And, you know, you take the water away, or you take the fire away, or you take the wind away, or take the earth away, then the body disappears, breaks apart. And same with our possessions. They're just things that are arising and passing away. And so by having, you know, the ability, a capacity to use our wisdom, then we can solve our problems. So it's not that we have to go looking for problems, but when sense objects arise, when thoughts arise, we can investigate right there. So if you're stuck in thought in a meditation, and you're finding it hard to meditate, then, you know, you look at the mind and you say, well, you know, if I've been meditating for 15 minutes, you know, is this really beneficial, or is there a better way that I can be doing this right now? I mean, that might be, you might change to your other meditation object that's more suitable to that moment. And, but it's not that you're always changing and chopping and changing, because it's like anything that, you know, if you dig 100 holes only a centimeter deep, then, you know, you haven't really dug a deep hole at all. So you still, actually in the commentaries, they say that there's only one type of person who can develop many meditation objects. So most people, it's recommended that you stick to a few. So you know, have your main meditation object. So like when I started, it was mainly the breath, with body relaxation and metta, you know, they were like the foundation. And then after a year or so, then I added the elements, and then I used skin as a meditation object. And then from skin 1 year, then I used fire. And but you know, I spent many months like developing it. So it's not just something that I would just, you know, change. Actually, I almost cried one day, because I tried so many different meditation objects in one day that felt like my head was going to explode. So you don't want to do that. So the idea is, it's just like putting the work in, doing the effort, showing up regularly, but also being perceptive. And so it's like studying. If you're not interested in what you study, if you're not relaxed when you study, then you're just going to waste lots of time. It's going to take you 3 to 4 times the amount of time. But if you have a level of interest there and you have a relaxed and attentive mind, then it's much easier to remember things. And so meditation is very similar. The way that I learn is more like quality over quantity. So quantity is good, but also, you know, don't just get in the habit of, letting the mind wander and that kind of thing. So we've got to, that's where this word spiritual urgency, samvega, comes in. That is this idea that, you know, you're not going to lose interest if your hair's on fire. Your clothes are on fire. You know, it's of vital importance. And so the mindfulness is, you know, what we hear in this pop culture today, everybody's talking about mindfulness. But in Buddhism, that mindfulness is directed to, you know, the body, the rise and fall. So that's usually when we're looking at the breath, investigating the arising, the falling, or the arising and falling. It naturally happens, but some people investigate it more. Or like with elements, that's what you do when you're looking at the elements, or aware of just a body even, you know. So just looking, putting your mind outside yourself, looking at back at the body and just saying, okay, well, what's here? You know, well, am I the skin? Am I the bones? Am I the blood? Where am I? No, one day I've got no hair, one day I've got some hair, one day I've got a cut on my face. Which one am I? So you use this to kind of break that perception that, you know, we're always here, we're always the same. And so you use it to kind of investigate, to come to an understanding that death is a part of life, that change is actually the constant. That's the only thing that is constant, is change. Everything else is arising and passing away. But what we can do is we can develop the mind. And so when in Buddhism, the Buddha has taught us the law of karma. And so karma means action. And from action comes result. And so you look at all the spiritual traditions of the world, and they don't just tell you to do nothing. They tell you that if you do certain actions, then, you know, you develop a path to heaven. And then the Buddha takes that further and says that as well as developing a mind of virtue, which is like a god, then we use that then to investigate the causes of suffering in the mind. But in order to do that, then we need very strong mindfulness. You know, so that's where the Buddha said, to realize nirvana, extinguishment of suffering, is 7 years or 7 months or 7 weeks or 7 days of unremitting mindfulness. And then that power of the mind directed to wisdom is then enough to break, you know, our delusion, to break Mara's lair. And so Mara is like the great puppet master. You know, so we're all used to like governments being the puppet masters, but we have this internal puppet master. And that puppet master is the really dangerous one, because it's the one that deludes us into complacency, into not living at our best, into not investigating and overcoming suffering when it arises, into following after the senses instead of, you know, finding time for meditation and peace. And so this process of being able to create a foundation in our practice is vital, because, you know, one day we're going to die, and at that point we're going to be separated from our body. And if we're not ready for that, we're going to be separated from our loved ones. We're going to be separated from our body. We're going to be separated from our possessions. Can't take our money with us. We can't take our car with us. We can't take our possessions with us. Can't take our hair with us. Nothing. But what we can take with us is our good karma. And so that's why the first step in Buddhism is, you know, generosity and sila. So learning moral restraint, because they're the things that stop beings from being reborn in hell. And to have them go through into the mind. So, you know, not learning not to kill. Because, I mean, look at killing. Even if you're killing an insect, the mind that requires to kill something, there's hatred there. You know, even if it's just a little bit, it's I don't want. You know, and so to get to a point where even you know whatever insect or rodent or whatever is your greatest fear, to get to the point where you can have respect for that being, because it's just a living being. You know. And then it's just another way of seeing the world. There's no room for hatred in the heart then. And it's not that, you know, beings are still the owners of their own karma, but the way that we're taught is, so if somebody shouts curses at you, then you think, well, at least they didn't throw sticks and stones at me. If they throw sticks at stones at you, well, at least they didn't cut me. If they cut you, at least they didn't mutilate me. If they mutilate you, well, their karma is their own. You know, so then you just have equanimity for the most heinous of crimes. But actually, most actions that people do, you know, it's not the worst action in the world. So we create all these stories, we create all these problems, and it's just like... like gossip, really. It's like this internal gossip program. So we have our own internal television station constantly commenting about things. Totally useless. And so that's where we start to see that it is like a puppet show. You know, so Mara is the puppeteer. And we're watching like a theatre show. But there's no audience there. You know, it's just us. But we're believing that the theatre show is true. And so, but it's only through the power of meditation, it's only through the power of a luminous heart that we have the ability to, you know, start to see that. That it's like we start to see those glimpses of delusion. And everybody's mind's different how wisdom arises. But you know wisdom when it arises, because wisdom leads to peace, leads to purification of the nervous system. So when true wisdom arises, the mind stops. So just like in meditation, when you meditate a lot, you know, you get to this where the Kanika Samadhi starts, where you're meditating a lot and then the breath stops, like dipping underwater or something, just for a brief time, and the mind becomes very peaceful. And wisdom's insight's the same. So when we develop true insight and we're practicing a lot, then it's very purifying to the nervous system. So, you know, this world at the moment is obsessed with the brain. But don't worry about the brain, because, you know, the best thing you can do is just do good actions, you know. And we take care of our body. We're like a custodian of our elements, but they're not ours. They're changing, you know. How many times have you gone to the toilet this life? I think that you're not the same person you were when you were a baby. So, but the idea that we can gather towards what is good means we require wisdom. Ajahn Chah said, we need wisdom at the start of the path, and not just at the end of the path. Because we have to learn to associate with what is good. Like a parent, if you always tell your child off, they'll become neurotic. But if you don't tell your child off after they've done something bad, then they won't learn and they may get in a difficult situation. And so we need to learn to be like a parent, like a teacher to our own minds. And so, you know, if we do things which lead to bad results, then the best thing we can do is to learn for it. You know, don't wait till we've done it three times. You know, and I think our modern age we suffer because we don't have very good memories, because we have, you know, televisions and digital phones and computers and all these things to remember everything for us. So I've found, you know, having a little journal, not necessarily to keep, you know, I tear it up as you go along. Every now and then you might reread it. But it's a way of kind of solidifying your thoughts and keeping a direction. So you know what is most important in your life. Because if we don't have values, if we don't have aspirations, if we don't have goals, then how are we going to have the desire to achieve those things? The idea that there is, you know, to have no goals and everything's going to sort itself out, I mean, how's that going to happen? So I think where people get it wrong is that we're meant to have humility, but, you know, we're meant to have strong desire. The word is chanda. And chanda is one of the spiritual faculties. So it's actually, the spiritual faculties is a synonym for the Eightfold Path. So most people are aware of the Eightfold Path, which looks at action. But the five spiritual faculties starts with faith. But the idea of faith is, first of all, we have to take on an assumption that this might be the right way to go. So it's not that we understand that it is the right way to go. We just look at other people and then, you know, from the words and actions and things that we've learned, we deduce that, okay, well, maybe this is the appropriate thing for me to do because these people say so and it looks like it's going to lead to this. But then we have to work out how we're going to get there and then what we need to remove in order to get there. And I've overcome many things in my life and many things which probably would have put many people in the grave. But if you just focus on one thing at a time and then you work out, you know, over the days and weeks, how to overcome that, and eventually a solution will come. It's just wisdom and patience. You know, so Kanti in Buddhism is has an element of endurance to it, that we don't shy away from suffering. You know, we don't need to take a Panadol every time we have an ache in the body. You know, we don't need to worry too much about things. If we have a bit of endurance, it means that when real suffering arises, that we're not going to lose our mindfulness. And if people find difficult with bodily pain, then learn sense restraint. And sense restraint is very simple. You just go through sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, thought, and see them as the six senses. See them as contact, as feeling, as perception. And then that investigation will lead to wisdom. And that wisdom will mean that pain won't have an effect over the mind anymore. I did this once. I thought I had an appendicitis and I was being taken to hospital. And I did this meditation in the car. And it was so effective, by the time I got to the emergency room, they thought I was making it up. Because I was so peaceful and at ease. And before that, I wasn't until I actually, you know, realized that I was serious and I had to do a meditation. It turned out to be a hernia. I think my intestine was caught or something. It was painful. But the idea is that usually it's the reaction to pain that is the problem. It's not the pain itself. The physical pain isn't, you know, a thousandth of what the mental pain is. The mental pain is when we go, I don't want that. I don't want that. And then we do that a million times in a second. And then we create this massive mountain of aversion towards whatever the thing is. And so when we can actually just see it, that it's just contact, it's just elements, it's just perception, it's just feelings, this is just nature arising and passing away, then we don't have to add on to it. We don't have to be tense. We don't have to fight it. You know, death comes to us all. Sickness comes to us all. The word in Buddhism is kutti. So it's not actually death when they talk about death. It's fading away. The fading away of the body. That's the difficult part. Because actually when you're dead, well, that's it. You're already separated from the body. So it's actually this... To prepare ourselves for that means that, you know, this idea of spiritual urgency, where we need to see what is really important in life. You know, is the television important? Is reading a book important? Or is meditating important? Is being generous important? Is feeding the homeless important? Is helping a sick family member important? So it's like getting our priorities right, because, you know, when we are good to the people in our lives, you know, that's the way that a society functions well. And so if we all do our part by just helping the people in our immediate vicinity in societies in a normal kind of way. I remember one person that I studied was Anandamattiya, one of the first Buddhist missionaries to England. And he was a Westerner who went over to Burma in 1905. And so this is, at that time there wasn't any orphans in Burma, because there was such a Buddhist country that, you know, there was no homeless people, none of this, because anybody, something would happen and you would just get assumed into the somebody else's family, you know. So it was like just part of their culture. They were very... devoted. And I think the problem with the Western society is we've all kind of grown up with the part of our culture hating religion. You know? And the problem with hating religion, it just means a series of actions, really. And so what if we don't have a series of actions that develop us on a spiritual path, then we just have a series of actions that develop us on a material path. And so this age of kind of nihilism and materialism just means that we have all of these nursing homes and pubs and mental asylums that are full. You know, so this is the product of our advanced society. It might be advanced in books and worldly knowledge, but we're not advanced in our actions. And but that's okay. You know, this is we've as a society we've been, you know, taught to go to the moon rather than to you know, sweep around the house. But that's okay, you know. So we just take whatever we have in our life and then we apply this idea of spiritual urgency to it. And then we just see, you know, what can we do? So you don't want to get to a point where you feel like you can't do it. And you don't want to also do the point where you don't do anything. And you certainly want to cut out the things that you know are bad. And so it's like building a fence, you know. If you build a fence, then you know where your chickens are. If you don't have a fence, then the chickens are lost. And so this is like our life. This is like our mindfulness. And so we need to start one thing at a time. What are the things that I need to do in order to have mindfulness? What are the things I need to do in order to have kindness? What are the things I need to do, you know, to sleep just enough to maintain the body and not indulge? What are the things I need to do to, you know, eat foods that help the body rather than just indulging in desire or whatever it is, you know? And then over time, that level of mindfulness means that we have moderation. And when we have moderation, then we're close to the middle path. And then that middle path You know, so we're not seeking after pleasure and we're not seeking to destroy the body. We're finding this kind of balance between it all. And in Buddhism they have what's called right view. And so right view is the idea of having the correct perspective. You know, so that's the start. If we're not looking in the right direction, then how are we ever going to get there? You know, has anybody ever got across the ocean to where they want to go by going in the opposite direction? Yeah, well, maybe a very long way around. So, you know, we need to have the right perspective. And that starts with worldly right view. And so the Buddha teaches us to look into karma. You know, what is the results of our actions? What is the results of our speech? What is the results of our thoughts? You know, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, gossip, aggressive speech, idle chatter, covetedness, greed, anger, hatred, irritation, wrong views. All these things, they bring suffering into our lives. And then the opposite of them, there's no suffering there. And then, depending on our ability, then there's the thing called the 10 praiseworthy qualities, where we can learn things like contentment and seclusion and fewness of desires. And these are the kind of qualities that really bring divinity to the heart. Because we're not just consumed by worldly desire. And then the one teaching I'll leave you with is the Mangala Sutta. You can look that up online. And the Mangala Sutta is great because a deva comes down and asks the Buddha, what is the highest blessing for devas and humans? And the Buddha gives the 32 lines or however many lines it is of all the things that it is to live a life that is a blessing, all the way up to enlightenment. You know, things like looking after our parents and discipline and that's highly trained and, you know, all of these qualities. So this is, these are the things that we can do. Like, just ask, you know, how can we be the greatest blessing to ourselves? Who was it? One of the forefathers of America. At the beginning of every day, he would ask himself, what good am I going to do this day? Jefferson, I think it was. And at the end of the day, he would ask himself again, now, what good have I done this day? And it's very skillful. So, okay, we'll do the meditation. Find ourselves in a comfortable position. See that the body, the legs, the arms, just in a reasonable upright position. Having the mind relatively upright, lets the body relatively upright, lets the mind be more upright. And just start by sweeping through the body from the tips of the hairs of the head, right the way through the body to the toes. Just relaxing every part of the body. And then from the toes, back up to the tips of the hair of the head. Suffusing the body with relaxation. In meditation, we can remind ourselves, just let the whole world vanish. As if everything was to vanish. We're just sitting here comfortably. We don't have to worry about anything. Now is the time just to have kindness, have peace and ease with ourselves and our meditation. Not a care in the world. Put down all external senses and put down emotions and stories of the heart. If there's any tension left in the body, you can just take a few deep breaths. Just allow the body to calm down even more. Body relax. Just relax the face, all the muscles of the face and the eyes. Like a soft smile on the eyes, let the eyes relax deeply. And then bring attention to the mind, to the heart, to the experience, whatever you want to call it. And just see the tendency of the mind wanting to go outside, flowing out into the world. Just give up that tendency. Content to be here for our meditation. Body relaxed, eyes relaxed. We give up the asavas. We bring our attention to our meditation object. If you have a meditation object, now's the time to bring it up. I'll give a guided metta and breath meditation. If you like a mantra, use metta. Just become aware of an in-breath coming in and out-breath going out. Just choose a point of contact. Metta is like friendliness, benevolence, luminosity and ease. Metta. Metta. Totally awake, totally at peace. There is no right or wrong in meditation. We just put in the causes. giving our full attention to the in-breath, giving our full attention to the out-breath. Being okay with whatever is. Tension, proliferation, irritation dissolve. Each in-breath and out-breath, a total attention. contented and satisfied. Using the breath with joy and ease. Metta.
unspeakable peace. Metta. Unshakable peace with the in-breath, unshakable peace with the out-breath. Metta. Bright sun. becomes the mind of the half hour meditation. Encourage ourselves for the benefit of practice. We can have this samvega, spiritual urgency. See the power of these simple actions. See the result. We share this kindness, this metta with those in this room, those on this property, the birds, the kangaroos, the devas, those in this city, this country, the world, the universe, the ambrosial, the three realms of existence. All beings everywhere, we share a kind thought. May all beings be happy and free from all forms of suffering and difficulty. May we develop compassion and appreciation for the goodness in ourselves and all beings. And may we take this peace with us into our lives. That's the end of the meditation. Let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest powers and evil forces, special beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpasses the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Avatu sabba mangalam. Rakhantu sabba devata sabba buddha nubhavena sada suti bhavantu te bhavatu sabba mangalam rakhantu sabba devata sabba dhamma nubhavena sada suti bhavantu te. sappamangalam rakkhantu sappa devata sappa sanghanupavena sadasuti bhavantu te.
You're good?